Go ahead.
Okay, once again, for identification purposes, my name is Vin Lewis, founder, president of All Roads Ministries, and I'm with
Jerry Matifix, director of Biblical Foundations.
We're in Front Royal, Virginia, at the invitation. I'm down here at the invitation and hospitality of Jerry, invited me down for literally co-production and sharing, and since we're both in the same business, do not consider ourselves competitors. One of the issues that came up that we were discussing when the original contacts were made is that, if I understood it correctly, Jerry mentioned that he went through what I guess we could call a second conversion, or perhaps a step-up stage spiritually last summer. Jerry, of course, has been an apologist and evangelist for about 6 years
about
now?
6 years.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Darn close to the amount of time I have been. Jerry, of course, came from being a former Protestant minister in the Presbyterian Church of America, and therefore takes, I guess, a slightly different approach, because I guess you were an apologist and evangelist just for different subject matters
for Protestants
almost all of your life.
Yeah.
Okay. So what you did was change the substance but keep the accidents the same, to talk in Catholic philosophical terms, which modern science has discarded.
That's right.
According to an anti-Catholic videotape we saw last night. Anyway, point is this. It appears to me, tell me if I'm phrasing it incorrectly before we start, that what you were driving at is that you felt that you had been defending Catholicism from a
irenic
point of view, which is a false sense of compromise and middle ground. Is that a proper way to define that word?
Yeah, that's part of the problem.
Okay, and that you essentially came to a realization that the approach has to be much more black-white, either-or, yes-no type apologetic approach, and that is the more proper way. Is that a good summary?
It's a summary of part of the change, not all of it. Some of it is an actual change in content and substance, not just style. And I can talk about those.
You mean
things
it was factually
too.
Incorrect on some things, you believe?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, well, that's a different story. Okay, now let's sort of, since we've done this before, what do you think brought this about? I mean, quite frankly, you were a person who has a name in the field.
Mm-hmm.
You were professionally successful.
Mm-hmm.
And having been converted, you were now doing what Catholics should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
You were, as sometimes professional athletes will describe, in a very good world, they get paid to do what they have fun doing. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So here you were doing what you like to do.
Mm-hmm.
It would appear to me that would lead to a situation of satisfaction, and satisfaction leads to a situation of contentment. And contentment means you don't change.
Mm-hmm.
What disturbed you to knock you off this contentment? What brought it about?
Okay, I'll have to modify something you just said.
Please.
Because it would create a falsely melodramatic scenario. It's not that I was content or complacent. I would have to say, and again, this is not any kind of boast or just something. It's just like my personality, the way that God has made me. I'm always restless in the sense of I want to know more.
Mm-hmm.
My problem is I stay up too late at night reading new books. I want to learn more things that I haven't learned about. So I'm always looking for improvement. So there's always been that sense of wanting to grow and being more faithful to the Catholic faith. But I can say that quantitatively, there was an enormous kind of shift in thinking I went through this summer and very early this fall, that has, I think, made a very noticeable difference in the way I come across to people. I mean, people have said, wow, you're coming across in a way that's very different than the way you did before. It's not that I was totally complacent and content to a certain point, just static and no change, and all of a sudden, boom, now I've changed. But this thing has really assumed a rather dramatic transition.
Okay, I didn't mean to imply complacency. What I was simply saying was this. If you are a professional baseball player and you enjoy playing professional baseball, you still take batting practice.
Right.
But you don't suddenly decide you want to be a catcher after being an outfielder.
Right.
You say, well, I've been an outfielder all this time. I enjoy it. I want to be the best outfielder I can. You improve your individual skills. What essentially you're telling me was is you decided you went from being a catcher to a peanut vendor. Okay, you're still in the ballpark,
mm-hmm.
but you saw your role is quite different.
No, I would say I'm still
okay.
a catcher, I'm still
okay.
a pitcher, but what I'm saying is I have thrown certain balls, just as a pitcher has different, you know, you have curve balls and spit balls. I've thrown certain balls that I felt justified in throwing before that now I realize, no, that isn't a legitimate kind of pitch. That shouldn't be going across the plate. I was told it's okay to pitch these kinds of balls, and now I'm saying, wait a minute.
Okay.
There's a whole different. I have a very different standard.
Sure. Allow me to put it in a context. A long time ago, I was trying to debate a gentleman by the name of White, who Jerry mentions he has debated before. He's an anti-Catholic Protestant in Colorado, and Mr. White to show me his, that is, White's debating skills, sent me two tapes in which Jerry debated him. And I remember at the time talking to people and saying, you know, Jerry wasn't strong enough on this and he wasn't strong enough on that. And when I know you formed your own organization, my first inclination was to call you immediately because the description of it seemed exactly like mine. And as Jerry mentioned, I wrote him a letter which was somewhat critical.
You wrote the letter back when I was still a Catholic answer.
Yes, that's when I first heard you debate. Okay, you were a Catholic answer at the time, and I wrote you the letter. Now, since then, I meant to call you when I first saw this. I said, gee whiz, I should at least get in touch with this guy, even if I just do my standard, you know, arrogant, sarcastic offering of help. I can, at the judgment seat, say, Lord, I tried to help, he just wasn't interested. I didn't get around to it. All right. Now, maybe I should have, but maybe it was providential, because the interesting point is, if I, now speaking to Jerry, and Jerry says, well, yeah, Ben, I saw your point of view and swung over to it. Jerry was convinced by a human agency. That's easy. I mean, you know, you drive a Ford and a guy convinces you Chevy's better, you buy a Chevy. That's easy to understand. But what I'm saying is, what is it that caused you to come about in this change? I mean, was it just a sense of improvement where, once again, as the journey from Protestantism to Catholicism, you started to see holes, or what? Did somebody talk to you?
Humanly speaking,
it was Damascus.
It wasn't a road to Damascus, but it was two things, I think. First of all, it was an increasing, and it is similar to the conversion to Catholicism in the sense that I can say from one level, while I am clearly on record saying that Protestantism is heresy, it's wrong, it's a defective view of the truth, in one sense, if you can understand it, my commitment to Christ, my wanting to be a Christian at the age of 14 and thinking that fundamentalism is true Christianity, simply my becoming a Catholic in 1986 was simply following through on the original commitment. Or as I became a Catholic to truly do what I had intended to do in 1972 and becoming a Christian. What I'm saying is the conclusions I've come to this summer and this fall in 1992 are simply really realizing in both senses of that word, making real, appropriating now what I intended to appropriate in becoming a Catholic 6 years ago. In other words, what I bought into 6 years ago, what I wanted was true, authentic Catholicism. What I've discovered is that much of what passes for that out in the world really is, it's so weak, it's so soft, it's so watered down, it's not what I wanted in the first place. And I would say there were two things going on here, Ben. One was an increasing sense of frustration with the kind of mainstream Catholicism that I was attempting to invite people to. I was constantly dealing with Protestants, and they were saying, well, look, you're asking me to become a Catholic. That means I got to start supporting gay rights legislation, and you know, I can't believe in capital punishment anymore, and I've got to believe in, you know, Velveteen Rabbit masses, and learn how to put clown makeup on, or help my priest learn how to put clown makeup on, those kinds of things. In other words, they were pointing to the problems in the church, or the problems of what I would have called the church. And I'm saying, no, you know, that. But it took so long to explain to them where to find the good stuff within the typical American Catholic Church experience that I began to get very depressed about that and thinking, why do I have to defend all this stuff all the time? Not that I was defending it, but I was saying that isn't relevant. The second thing was the catalysts were some books that I read this summer and two people that actually came on a Catholic conference at sea or cruise that I was a speaker, the featured speaker at, who gave me a bunch of literature also and some conversations they had that really kind of slapped me in the face, rhetorically speaking, and made me take a good hard look at what was going on in the typical American Catholic Church and realize that I can't defend this anymore. I'm not inviting people to the American Catholic experience anymore. I'm inviting them to traditional Catholicism. And what that means is, I'm not going to say, well, take this mixed bag. Boy, there's a lot of lousy stuff in it, but there's some good stuff in it too. And you'll be able to pick your way through this minefield, and hopefully your foot won't get blown off, you know. And I'm saying, that isn't authentic Catholicism. Don't even bother with that. Find an expression, an embodiment of good, authentic Catholicism. Another example would be, what does the church teach on X, Y, or Z? All the people hear nowadays is, well, you know, we don't, since Vatican II, we don't have to believe what the Council of Trent said. The Council of Trent pronounced anathemas on people who deny the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. We don't talk that way anymore. So the Catholicism that you're asked to embrace is a very tolerant Catholicism. You're not wrong, just we're a little bit better than you. Wouldn't you like to be better? Yeah, then become a Catholic. Okay, but you're not wrong. We're not condemning Protestantism. And I began to realize, and people would always say, well, if you're not condemning Protestantism, then why did the church, was the church wrong in the Council of Trent? Why did the church have this condemning tone to its statements for you know, 1960 years? And I got to the point where I had to realize they're right. The Catholicism that I have to defend is the Catholicism that has been consistent for 1960 years and still has its representatives today, but they're not out near the typical American Catholic experience. In other words, I know I'm kind of beating around the bush here because I'm not being specific. Okay. What I'm saying is we Catholic apologists have got to say, I defend the Council of Trent. No ifs, ands, or buts. I defend the Crusades. I defend the Inquisition. I defend all of those things as authentic Catholicism. And to whatever extent the typical politically correct marketing representative of Catholicism today says, ooh, this stuff just won't sell in our American culture. Let's ignore all this stuff. Let's hide it in a closet and say, we didn't really do those things, or we did them, but we're totally embarrassed and we will never do that kind of thing again. I'm saying, no, I'm not going to go with this Benedict Arnold who's saying, I will give you the new improved Catholicism. That's what you should buy, Protestants. I want to defend what the church has been doing for 2,000 years.
As I pointed out to you personally, I have real problems with acceptance. I'm quite used to rejection. I'm quite used to beating people on the head and trying to force them into my right. But it's very difficult for me to deal with someone, especially in the same profession or on the same level, who is saying the same things I say. So the point is, you know, here's someone else saying we have to defend the Inquisition. I find it, you know, very refreshing. But let me ask you now, before this, would you have been, quote, embarrassed as a Catholic by the Inquisition? Or would it have been that you never inquired? I mean, what was the mindset? You see, with me, I, as a Catholic, I remember this several times when I was younger. Mm-hmm. I had a sort of pushy Catholicism attitude, mm-hmm. which was, well, they're Protestants, what do they know? Even like in the fifth grade, I would say that, mm-hmm. you know, that a Catholic would always have a better chance of getting it right. He wouldn't mm-hmm. necessarily be a better baseball player, but mm-hmm. a Catholic musician would be better than a Protestant musician, or a Catholic baseball player would be better than a Protestant baseball player, everything else being equal. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, when it came to things like the Inquisition and the Crusades, I did never had the concept that it was automatically wrong. I looked at it as I looked at when I thought the American criminal justice system was good, mm-hmm. that it was a good system which could be individually abused. My mindset was automatically that way. What I'm saying is, it appears to me that many Catholic apologists, quote unquote, go from two approaches. Number one, let's not deal with the issue at all. There's a lot of things we'd rather not bring up. It's like when your father's drunk at the wedding, nobody mentions it, okay? Mm-hmm. You just sort of look the other way. Everybody's slightly embarrassed. Or you admit that the Crusades was a terrible, terrible part of Catholic history. We're very, very sorry. We really apologize. We'll never do it again. Please forgive us. Everybody's at fault, after all. Mm-hmm. None of us are perfect. Mm-hmm. Do you remember what your mindset was at that time?
It was, it probably varied from situation to situation. It was one or the other of the two. In other words, when I worked for another apologetics organization, I think I imbibed the general style or manner or tone or whatever you want to call it of that organization. But I just got the impression this is the way we do apologetics today. We don't take the hardcore pre-Vatican II approach. We, in other words, in a sense, what we're defending is what there is today, and we don't have to really worry about what existed prior to 1960. That's
is that the church were founded a short time ago?
Well, I realize just in saying that that's going to sound very unfair. You know, someone working for that organization hearing me now would say, well, what do you mean? Of course we talk about those things, and they do. I'm talking, it's a subtle thing, but to me it's a clearly noticeable thing.
Matter of emphasis.
It's a matter of emphasis, yeah. In other words, we don't emphasize the things before. We start with the current documents and read the other ones in the light of it, rather than the other way around. What I'm saying is I want to really, I'm not that interested anymore in knowing from 1960 to 1992. What I would really like to do is know that I know very accurately what the church taught up till 1960. And then, with that as a given, that has got to be true. Now, with that as my filter, I work through what's happened in the last 32 years, and I'm willing to reject huge acres and acres of it if they don't jive with that other yardstick. And I'll say, I won't defend, you know, this particular statement, this particular policy. I think it's an act of betrayal or an act of apostasy or what have you. Rather than starting with the contemporary Catholic thing as the given and then saying, now, what in the past doesn't line up with that? Ooh, we better not talk about that.
Before, on one of the other discussions we had, we talked about sort of a five-step program, becoming an apologist, mm-hmm. and you mentioned, I was more Bible emphasis than you, I think, but I think now I understand why. When you said another authoritative document, what you're saying is the apologist has to have a selection to understand what he's defending, which is real Catholicism, and what he shouldn't defend because it isn't Catholicism at all.
I'm saying the problem with the average would-be contemporary Catholic apologist today is that he or she will probably pick up the kind of books I described in the other tape, the book written by the apologist who's written many, many books, who's soft on some issues. He's like, yeah, Jesus was probably incarnate on many worlds and died in many different forms, and so when we get to heaven, we'll see him as a bug-eyed monster, you know, as well as a human being and God and all those other things. I'm saying that there's a lot of flabby and fallacious and heretical Catholicism out there, even being promoted and propagated by apologists. And the reason is because all they read is the contemporary mushy statements. They don't have anything with masculinity, okay, virility, something that's very...
substance.
It's clarity, too. I mean, when I read the documents of the Council of Trent, boy, oh boy, there's no mistaking it. You might be infuriated if you're a president reading it, but you know exactly what they teach. You know exactly what's wrong with the heresy. You read a document, forgive me, even by, you know, official documents coming out today, and the rhetoric is so political. There's so much studied ambiguity. You're not really sure, am I wrong? Am I on the right path? You know, do they really think I'm a bad guy? I'm not really too sure about this. And I like clarity.
Okay.
I like the clarity of Trent. I do not like the clarity of things, you know, in more recent history.
Okay. Let me play, as you say all the time, devil's advocate. Aren't you in danger of becoming more Catholic than the Pope? Really? I mean, after all, now you just made a criticism,
yeah.
And it was a veiled criticism of the papal statements,
okay.
And I make the criticism.
Let me take
the
high ground.
I've written this.
Mm-hmm.
I pointed out that, and I like to say it all the time, read Leo the 13th.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't, you know, 50,000 years ago. He was modern time. The translations we have of Leo the 13th make extremely clear exactly what he's talking about. He's talking about sometimes profound, complex issues, the nature of God, the nature of man, will, free will. He's very easy to understand, but he also is extremely precise. You know exactly where he stands. But I wrote a point about how eloquence is a trap. And in the desire to be eloquent, it seems like the current Pope has written so many things which are so vague, so many extra words, that you can take any one of his paragraphs and reduce it to about a four-word sentence. And it's usually something like this, man is capable of good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're saying that isn't really the Catholicism you want to defend, aren't you in danger of falling into the apt description of being more Catholic than the Pope?
Let me take the offensive and question. I've heard that all the time.
My kind of technique. Go ahead.
I've heard that all the time. Ooh, you're going to be more Catholic than the Pope. The assumption always is that isn't possible or that isn't prudent. And I would immediately question that assumption and say, what is wrong with being more Catholic than the Pope? Or is it bad to be more Catholic than the Pope? Is it possible to be more Catholic than the Pope? In other words, where in Catholic theology it teaches that the Pope is always the very best representative of Catholicism? As I understand it, we've never taught that. In other words, was Paul being more Catholic than the Pope at Antioch in Galatians 2? Yes, he was. He was saying to Peter, Peter, you and I agree, we agree on the gospel, but you're not being consistent with it. You're being, he called him a hypocrite. He said, you're not living in line with the gospel, and I'm here to remind you of what you and I agree on. And Peter humbled himself and submitted to the correction of his fellow apostle. Now, let me stop right now before someone says, wait, Jerry, now you're saying you're the apostle. No, I'm not. I'm simply illustrating a principle there. I am not saying that I see myself as the Apostle Paul. I don't feel I have any charism or any obligation or any vocation from God to criticize John Paul II or any of the more recent popes. I want to walk a very razor's edge here. I don't want to, because ultimately every person, as Paul would say, let every man be, you know, is accountable to God. God will make the final judgment. I'm not judging anyone's heart. I'm not saying I'm more Catholic than the Pope. I would have no way of knowing that. I don't know the Pope. I don't have any yardstick by which I would never want to say I'm superior to the Pope. However, having said that, I will defend in theory, the possibility that an individual Catholic might be more faithful to Catholic tradition than a particular pope is. That does not call into question papal infallibility, which is a very narrow circumscribed doctrine. That is, when the pope speaks ex cathedra, he will never formally define a dogma that would repudiate what the church has taught before. But he may do things that are inconsistent with the claims, the creeds, you know, the dogmatizations of the church. For example, I mean, we saw this anti-Catholic video we watched last night made hay out of the World Day of Prayer held at Assisi in 1984. Here are all the representatives of all the religions of the world there that the Pope has called. Now, his intentions might have been sound. He might have said, look, let's not be at each other's throats. Let's learn to respect each other. And at some level of mere human, human respect, of course, has another connotation for us, but at some level of decency, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, I should be able to sit next to an African animist and say, let's have a conversation here where I can at least be courteous and polite and hear what you have to say, once you hear what I have to say, so on and so forth. Okay, maybe that's all he was attempting, but the fact of the matter is that I think that caused scandal. And it's very difficult for me to say this on a tape, and this is the first time I've ever said anything like this, and it's been captured on a tape. But I think that so many people were confused by that example and said, what is being said here is that all the religions of the world they're all praying to the same God. That's what the headline of the paper said that they showed in this video. All religions of the world pray, asking God. The fact is they're all praying different gods. And false gods are demons, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10. So we have here, I think the same Paul who rebuked Peter at Antioch would, based on what he says in 1 Corinthians 10, had he been there, would have said, can you have communion? Can you eat from the table of the demons and the table of the Lord at the same time? I think that was an error of judgment. That is my opinion. I'm willing to be publicly rebuked for that. In other words, if someone can show me that I am sinning in making that criticism, I will publicly recant to that. I'll recant to this recantation. But I have to call it as I see it. And right now, what I would say is a lot of people were so turned off by that. A lot of Protestants I deal with, they will say, hey, I'm not going to join a church which is going to tell me that all roads lead to heaven, regardless of whether you're worshiping trees and snakes or what have you. They say, if that's what this Pope's agenda is, I'm not interested. They thank you very much. They hang up, and I think, darn, that angers me, and I think it should anger me. In other words, I have a justifiable anger about the scandal that has turned away what otherwise might have made an honest seeker of the truth come into the Catholic Church.
Now, along a related line, doesn't this not lead you over into charge of being holier than thou? I mean, here comes a guy.
No.
Well, let me finish my point.
Go ahead.
Okay. Here comes a guy from another church, converts, sincerely, no doubt about that, has certain talents, certain abilities, certain knowledge, no doubt about that, gets involved with a major Catholic apologetic organization. Gee, that's a wonderful thing to do. Then he leaves, and instead of becoming, Joe Teacher somewhere or Joe Mechanic, he now forms his own organization saying, hey, wait a minute, I know the right way to do it. Then, after forming the organization, he says, wait a minute, I didn't know the right way to do it, I know the right way now. And, I'm really better than you people. I got insights you don't have. I really am holier than you. Listen to me. I'm explaining it the right way now. Mm-hmm. Isn't that a charge that could be leveled against?
On the other tape, I think we're going to be, I'm going to be interviewing you, and so you can defend those kinds of statements. I will simply say this, and I hope you don't consider this an act of betrayal on my part. I wouldn't use language like that. If you might feel comfortable saying, yeah, I don't have any problem saying I'm better than you or I'm holier than you, that's just not my style. I don't feel.
But you know what the words mean. The point is, whether you'd use the words or not, if somebody accused you of it, and I'm doing it now just for purposes of this, you understand it, how do you justify yourself? How do you explain yourself? How do you explain, hey, listen, I'm Jerry Matatix, and I'm telling you the truth, and I'm telling you what's real here, and I'm telling you you better defend the real Catholicism and ignore the rest, or at least don't even feel obligated to defend it. And I say, thank you very much for your opinion, Jerry, but who are you to tell me this?
See, that's why I would minimize I wouldn't talk about myself that much. I wouldn't say I am telling you. What I would keep the personal pronouns to an absolute minimum.
Now, Biblical Foundation tells me that, but Biblical Foundations is Jerry Matatix.
Okay, but even so, what I'm going to say is, look, the point is not what Jerry Maddox is saying, although obviously I'm the one talking about it. What I'm saying is, look, forget me. Read the doctrine of the Council of Trent. Read this document here. Read the word anathema. Read what this has to say. Now let's look at this current statement of this bishop or this archbishop or whatever. Is he as robust and as virile and as authentically Catholic as this document? No. Well, then you draw your own conclusion. See what I'm saying? I wouldn't say I'm better than that bishop or I'm more faithful to the Council of Trent. I would simply say I'm holding up, don't look at me, I'm holding up two things. I'm saying here's what Trent says, here's what this current bishop says. He's not standing up for Catholicism, is he? No. Okay. That's the way I would approach it.
Okay. Aren't you in a certain, again, I'll level another charge to you. We let me see if it's proper to describe it this way, again, to put it into context. You've gone from a soft Catholic apologist to a hard Catholic apologist. Would that be a proper way to put it?
I never, well, again, terms are relative. I never
that's
would.
That's the point. It's a relative change.
Yeah.
It's still relative, Catholic at both times.
I would say softer to harder.
Okay.
I would say that from the word go, I was always hard on some things. I was never as soft as other people that I would, you know, consider seriously soft now. But what I'm saying is I've become much harder. And I think that in becoming harder, I'm becoming more faithful to the vocation of an apologist. In other words, an apologist should not be mellowing out, especially as we move into a time of crisis in our country. I think we don't have time to dance around as much anymore. We've got to be blunter. We've got to get to the point while still being courteous. I think courtesy and charity are non-negotiables. They've always got to be in place. But you can be courteous and be tough at the same time.
Okay. Wouldn't someone accuse you, perhaps, of defending less Catholicism? In the sense of this, as you've implied clearly, certain actions of the Pope you would not defend.
Mm-hmm.
But the Pope, by definition, in all his actions, is associated with Catholicism. Aren't you becoming, in a sense, more selective, maybe just out of, again, a charge, that you don't want to deal with the embarrassing aspects of the faith? You're picking and choosing your targets and not defending the entire panorama of Catholicism.
Well, I would say the idea that I've got to defend everything the Pope does is a false. That isn't really more Catholicism than I'm defending. That's a specious argument. I would say that person misunderstands what his obligation is. His obligation is not to defend everything that every Catholic's ever done, including popes, any more than Paul had to defend to Peter and say, well, Peter, you know, I understand why you're not eating at the table with these people anymore. That's an interesting point of view. I have a different one. You know, he didn't feel obligated. And papal infallibility, properly understood, does not require me to say, whatever the Pope does, that's great with me. I think that that's not a more generous approach. It's a false approach. And that's the danger. There's no danger in being more Catholic than the Pope. The danger would be saying, whatever the Pope does is fine with me.
That would be sort of being exactly as Catholic as the Pope, wouldn't it be? In a certain sense. Whatever he says, it's okay.
And I would say, in that case, you're really being un-Catholic, because
yeah,
the true Catholic faith. St. Catherine of Siena rebuked the popes who were becoming very complacent in Avignon, France. And she said, you're sinning. You need to be back in Rome. You are taking the easy way out. She was a saint. St. Robert Bellarmine, many of the great saints who are theologians in the church, the doctors of the church, have told us, as St. Catherine of Siena was a doctor of the church, have told us that it is permissible to respectfully, and I want to emphasize the word respectfully, to respectfully disagree with our ecclesiastical superiors, our priests, our bishops, and even our Pope himself, who's a bishop. What I'm saying is, I up until this point, I was unwilling to be critical of people like that. And I'm beginning to realize now, out of fidelity to Christ, sometimes we have to criticize in humility. The first we have to do, and there's a lot of dangers, a lot of pitfalls here, we have to look at our own eye, make sure we don't have a beam in our own eye. We've got to examine our own conscience. We've got to say, I'm a lousy sinner too. I betray Christ in all kinds of ways. We have to admit our own faults and say, I'm not claiming to be holier than thou, but you are doing something wrong. The way I put it to a talk on this very cruise is, I said, you know, I have sat through homilies before where the priest said something wrong, said something heretical. And I just sat and stewed and said, oh, I can't believe I heard that homily. Here would be an example of a dramatic change. I'm not saying this to be dramatic or to advertise myself, but I'm at the point where I won't tolerate that anymore. The next time that happens, if I'm in a, I'm just saying he says something I disagree with, it's a different opinion. But if the Pope, if the priest said in a homily, Jesus did not know he was God until after the resurrection, I would stand up and say, that is heresy, that is wrong. I will not listen to this, and I call upon all true Catholics to get up out of their seats and march out of this church right now. Do not listen to this, folks. We'll have to find another, I hope there's another mass meeting somewhere in time that we won't be subjected to this kind of heresy. That is, I think, my obligation. I wouldn't have seen it that way before. I wouldn't say that way before, but now I see the times are so critical. We've got to, and that's a hard thing to do. My heart would be pounding.
Don't go any farther, because that's going to lead to my next question. The key thing is why. Simply this, I think you would say that if a Catholic attended a Mass like that, and the priest said that, and the Catholic did not get up and walk out, he wouldn't go to hell as a result. He would say, well, I don't buy that, or he wouldn't pay attention. He would still stay in Mass. He would not go to hell because he does not denounce the priest openly. That is not to criticize you. It's just to point out that if what you're doing by taking the harder approach, by taking the, I don't have to defend everything the Pope says, by taking the, well, I've got to be more circumspect on these things, I've got to examine things more. If that's not necessary, why do it? Why did you change? After all, let me put it this way again. Before, what you were doing was good. Agreed?
To some extent. I mean, not perfectly good.
On a scale of good or bad, you were doing good. You were defending the faith.
Okay.
You were doing it to, maybe not the best of your ability, but you were certainly making an effort at it. It was a sincere effort.
Mm-hmm.
You were giving up time at home to travel around, to defend the faith, to explain the faith.
Okay,
to
so what?
And now you're still doing good. Why change? Why did you go from a good to a good? Why did you do this?
Well, ultimately, I have to believe it's the Holy Spirit convicting me, as He convicts all of us, to be more faithful. In other words, this couldn't be coming from... I would have no merely human reason to want to put myself in a totally embarrassing situation and do this. I've got to believe God is saying, you don't feel like doing this, you don't like doing it, it's embarrassing, you're going to have, you know, rivulets of sweat pouring out of both armpits as you stand to do this, but the only reason to do it would be that it's to testify to the truth. I think a lot of people are just being, look, if he walked up in the pulpit and he pulled out a machine gun, he started shooting people, and I said, well, he's the priest, you know, who am I to stop him and take the machine gun out of his hand, you know? I mean, I don't want to disrupt the Mass for Pete's sake.
Catholic attitude,
yeah.
Vatican too.
Yeah, I would say, look, I don't want to disturb the liturgy, this is some liturgical dance, it's the flop and bleed on the floor, you know, thing, I'm not in charge here, I'll just be submissive. Nobody would do that. Nobody in their right mind would do that. They would say, that guy's got a gun. Get up there and take it out of his hands. Because why? Because we value human life. I value the soul a lot more than the body. And if the priest gets up and says, Jesus didn't really rise from the dead, or he didn't really know that he was God, or you know, Mary didn't really assume to heaven, it's just a pictorial way of saying that she's an elevated woman, or something like that. If he's denying a dogma of the faith, he is doing far more serious damage to the people in the pews than a man with a machine gun. He's only killing their bodies. Maybe they're dying in a state of grace, they're all going to heaven. He's doing them a favor. But the man who is giving them heresy, and they might think, well, he's the priest. He went to seminary. He should know. And they don't know anybody because they don't have catechetical materials that are trustworthy at their disposal. Then he is damning their souls. And if I let that happen, then I'm not loving them and I'm not loving him. And to be Vinny Lewis, I'm not loving myself, because maybe I wouldn't go to heaven if I didn't say anything, Vin. Maybe God would say, Jerry, what do you care about most? You know, being socially accepted? Or do you care about the truth? If he's denying the truth, and if I know that he's doing it, then I have an obligation to stand up and say, that is a lie. That is a heresy. And folks, don't listen to him. And I would say, with all due respect, Father, I love you, Father. I respect you as a priest. I'm not attacking you as a priest. I'm not attacking your priesthood. I'm saying, you are teaching something that the church... And don't take it from my word. Don't take my word for it, folks. Read this magisterial document itself. This says it's a dogma of faith that Christ knew that he was God, or whatever the dogma that's being attacked is. He bodily rose from the dead. You must not accept what this priest says, because he's not infallible. It's not part of Protestantism. The priest is always infallible. And by doing that, I'm loving the priest. And I would say, I say this in all respect, all humility, Father. And if I'm wrong, correct me. Reprove me. Reprove me. Show that I'm wrong.
Okay.
And by the way, I would say that to the listeners of this tape, too. In other words, if what I have just said, that I should stand up in a Mass and do that, if that's wrong, if some saint says, never said that, then show me and you know, I'm willing to recant. Stop me before it actually happens in some parish somewhere. But right now, that's the way I feel. You ask me an honest question, I'm giving the answer. I feel if I was in that kind of situation, my solemn obligation before God, so that God wouldn't say, Jerry, all these people went to hell, and you didn't tell them, because they all stopped believing the deity of Christ. You didn't warn them that they were listening to heresy. I've got to warn them. Does that make any sense?
Yes, but it wasn't an honest question. It might have been an honest answer. It was a hypothetical question. As you understand, I'm trying to put you in a corner, even if I agree with you, simply because I'm trying to get, you know, it out. Okay. I once met a lady who was an atheistic Jew. She was raised as a cultural Jew, not a religious Jew in New York City, but she was raised to be an anti-Catholic. She woke up one day, literally wrote the Damascus story, understanding Jesus Christ was God and Lord, and she had to get in touch with him. But because she had been raised to be an anti-Catholic, she went to every Protestant church she could. It didn't make any sense. So she said, well, process elimination, I got to try Catholic church. So she went to a Catholic church and went into an RCIA program, which was, quote, filled with heresy, unquote. And I said, wait a minute, I stopped her right there. I said, if you don't know what Catholicism was, how did you know what heresy was? She said, I don't know. But it was all heresy, I found out later. And I'd like to tell this story that this is the working of God literally through people sure. saying, you look for the truth, I'll find it. Here's Jerry coming to be Catholic. Agreed, no problem. Jerry joins an organization which he later leaves primarily with philosophical theological differences. Then he forms his own, and then he reforms his own. How come he didn't get it right the first time?
Mm-hmm.
Seriously.
Good question.
Oh, yeah. So I'm trying to put you on the spot, okay? you should have known that when you invited me down here.
Well, I mean, the cliched response would be, but I mean, when I say it's cliched, it's sincere on my part, too. Life is a pilgrimage. We're on the way, and there are blind spots we have. We accept certain things because other people tell us this is the way it's done, and we can't examine everything all at the same time. In other words, there are certain things that are givens. And someone says, well, you know, you don't question this, you don't question that. And you say, okay, fine. But when you get the chance to, and you say, oh my gosh, I've been wrong, then you change. That's all.
Okay.
In other words, I've got every year. I'm sure next year I'll read books. I'll be even more critical of certain things that I wasn't. For example, we talked about yesterday. I never criticized the basic validity of the American Revolution until I began to read certain books, saying, "Wait, this was a demonic thing." Now I believe. Now I understand that. And so I have an obligation to critique the American Revolution from the basis of further truth. God is always leading us further on. And hopefully I will be more critical of other things that I think are benign or okay now, that next year I'll realize are more dangerous or satanic or whatever.
Do you think some of this could have been attributed to sloth?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. So in a certain sense, it's
not self-conscious sloth necessarily, but okay. Simply saying, oh, I've had a hard day, I'll just pop in a, you know, I'll watch a movie here rather than... read my Bible for another hour, or read the Doctrines of the Council of Trent.
Okay. So what this really just goes to show us is the danger of complacency, huh?
Sure. Again, with the qualification that I would never have described myself as a complacent person. I never said, I'm satisfied with what I know now. I know enough. Anyone who knows me knows that I am not a complacent person. I'm always restless. As a matter of fact, my problem is the other way, that I'm always thinking, I shouldn't send this tape out. I should redo it and make it better, you know. I mean, I'm a perfectionist. So I'm not, my sin isn't complacency. My sin is procrastination. It's the other way. But I would put it this way. It's naivete, maybe, thinking, I think I've got it right now, rather than saying, have I really examined all the ministerial documents I should have?
Okay. But now, if I'm understanding correctly, the difference is that now what you've done is examine these things and draw conclusions before you didn't examine them and went on certain presumptions. Would that have been correct?
I would say that before now...
You examine them in a cursory fashion rather than... Again, I mean, I'm sure, yeah. I would assume when you came into the church, you mentioned the Council of Trent, almost everybody does.
Yeah.
You must have read something about the Council of Trent, seen the language, which you're right, it's perfectly clear, it's perfectly condemnatory.
Yeah.
All right, now you're looking at them and saying, gee, we're not talking this way anymore, and we should be talking this way, or we should be at least getting closer to talking this way.
Yeah.
Is it because that before maybe you examined them simply for doctrinal points of view, and now you're examining them also for like the concept of style, approach, substance?
I think that's it. I think I'm more comfortable with the style of the old stuff as well as the doctrine. But I think also I was aware of what those old documents said. But people were saying, well, we don't put it this way anymore now. And so I said, well, fine. In other words, I was attracted to old-style Catholicism. That's what attracted me. It wasn't namby-pamby Catholicism.
That's an interesting point.
I was attracted by Tridentine-type, you know, Catholicism. But when I came into the church, I didn't find that actually being practiced anywhere. So I thought, well, I'll settle for, you know, what I can get. What I'm discovering now is, no, you can find that if you're willing to look a little harder. There are pockets of this still available somewhere. It might mean driving in a car half an hour. It might mean going to old used bookstores because these kind of books aren't in print anymore or whatever. But I'm saying we've got to make a deeper effort. If you just look at what's available in your parish or what's available in your local Catholic paper or what the diocesan paper says, you'll never encounter this hardcore Catholicism. You've got to go into the next county or a little bit further, but it is there. And I'm saying make the effort to find it.
Okay, sure. So in other words, what you did was having intellectually decided and emotionally and spiritually that mm-hmm. the Catholic Church was correct, you came in, and then you met people who, by any definition, were Catholics, and they said, well, here it is, Jerry. And you said, well, gee, it looks a little different than I thought, but mm-hmm. I've made the decision, so I'll just accept it the way it is.
Yeah.
Okay. I
didn't think anyone was practicing the old way anymore, and now I've discovered those people
totally
are out there.
You mentioned, I think, before we started recording that you would have liked to had some comments you made on tapes take back. So let me put you in a spot on one, which I remember quite specifically.
Go ahead.
A friend of mine from North Carolina sent me a debate of yours with Dave Hunt. Dave Hunt, for people who are not familiar, is a significantly famous evangelical, but primarily anti-Catholic on the West Coast. Writes a lot of books, mm-hmm. does some debating, etc. And you debated him. I can't remember the exact topic, but one of the subjects that came up was the burning of heretics.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was, is he mentioned to the effect of, as Protestants usually do, that the Catholic Church had burned, you know, usually like 200 million, thousand zillion people at the stake in 1 year alone in just Lyon, France.
Mm-hmm.
And your reply was something like this, that if you actually looked at the statistics and really looked at the historical records, you would find that Henry VIII burned more in 1 year mm-hmm. than the Catholic Church burned in 1,000.
But I admitted that it was wrong.
I objected to that approach, and I'll tell you why in a moment. But I'm asking you, if that same issue came up right now, how would you answer
totally it? Totally differently. That's a good example. And I should have asked you to do more of these. I don't know if you have any other ones besides that one, but let's get them on there here quickly. Yeah, I said, oh, it wasn't that many. It wasn't 20 million, it was 20,000. And you guys did it too, so what? And at a certain level, that's valid. But that's all that I would have said. Now I would go further and say, yeah, we burned heretics, and wouldn't any person who really loves God and obeys the Bible do the same? In other words, isn't truth more important than human life? In other words, I would have taken the high ground. I would have questioned his assumption. His assumption is that no one should be punished for propagating an erroneous doctrine. I would have said, wait a minute, you know, Mr. Hunt, don't you accept what God told Moses to do to idolaters and heretics in the Old Testament Israel? Wasn't the Catholic Church simply being faithful to the Bible? We don't do that anymore. It's not politically correct. But maybe we're wrong, and the older classical approach was correct. I would stand with the Inquisition and with the legitimacy in a Catholic state of executing people who, after sufficient warning, not just simply grabbing someone, what do you think? Oh, okay, I'm going to kill you. I mean, that's a caricature. That's not what they did. But you have a law that says you are not allowed to proselytize people to a false faith to lead them to hell. You warn them about that. If they will not desist, then you banish them. You don't kill them. You simply say, you know, you're out of here. If they won't leave, they say, I'm going to stay here and do that. Then you put them to death. But they know it. They know the penalty up front. There's no injustice in it, in the sense that you're not surprising them. They know they're willfully going against the law. If they don't like that law, they should leave that nation and find another nation where they're free to worship Satan.
My co-founder of this organization, a lady named Cindy Hoff, whenever I ask her for, can you think of anything else I should say in debates or discussions, always says, well, make sure you invite them into the church.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an interesting point. On your tapes, I never heard that. Was that there?
Really? Oh, no, I think I've done that.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And maybe I didn't hear it. Okay.
As a matter of fact, I generally...
I simply forgot.
Yeah. I feel very strongly. Now, again, I will not admit, I need to... one of the things is I have not listened to an awful lot of my tapes.
Okay,
I
fine.
Don't have time. But my impression is that I always feel an obligation before the thing is over to say, whatever you thought of the debate tonight or what have you, I urge you, I entreat you to come into the Catholic Church.
Okay, here's the point I was going to make.
Yeah.
A very key point, the word used was obligation. Okay.
Yeah.
So in other words...
I may not have always used that word.
That's fine. That's not the point. We're talking about your status now.
Yeah.
You're saying, therefore, then, that the proper apologetic approach or debate always must include a Catholic altar call,
yes,
so to speak.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay? It is not merely a discussion of intellectual values and who can make a better case.
Right.
Would you say that's a major difference of what you thought before as opposed to what you think now?
No, I always wanted people to become Catholics before, but I didn't put it as an obligation. Yeah, I didn't call for repentance, you might say.
Yeah. Would you have criticized, in the old way, a Catholic apologist who debated a particular issue, did it well, walked away without ever throwing in the conclusion?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Would you have, in the old way, would you have criticized them? I know you would criticize them now. That's the point. I'm trying to get a mindset difference.
Yeah, I don't. It would depend. Probably not. I might have said in the old way, it's not necessary that you make the appeal every
okay.
single time.
So
now I would say yes.
So
you have no guarantee.
Then let me see if I can draw a conclusion here, because also notice something you said when you were rephrasing your response to Hunt, is that you used the word you several times,
mm-hmm.
which is very interesting. It seems to me that what you've really said here is that you went from making the faith doctrinal defensible, logical, biblical, scriptural, into our incarnational. You took the faith, which could be defended, explained, advanced on an intellectual basis, and now you make it a thing where it's a direct appeal to an individual and a request that that person take it into himself and make it part of himself instead of simply accept the doctrine.
No, that if I can respectfully disagree with you, that is not the difference. I was always personal, but I think before I had a far... I realize. Before, I didn't think the plight of the Protestant was as dangerous as it is now. Now I'm far more cynical about how many Protestants really are invincibly ignorant or honest seekers after the truth. I think they're skating on thin ice that's going to crack at any moment. Okay. And so the urgency impels me to be a lot more forthright and say, you are in a dangerous situation. You should repent today. Don't wait till tomorrow. Don't take 6 months to study this. Become a Catholic now, as soon as possible.
Okay. Fine answer,
and I think that wraps it up.